our new title of our show is A Folk Fellowship with the Wizard Baldur. How you doing, Wizard?
I'm doing good.
Good. And we have our a guest today who is going to interrogate us about what folk fellowship is. And your name is?
Trip Overholt.
Yeah, so Trip is going to attempt to keep us honest, which will be very difficult, considering that this title of this is Folk Fellowship with the Wizard Baldur and the Reverend Paul. Yes, and I'm Reverend Paul, and the Wizard is also known as John Troy, but we'll be calling him Wizard. So, Mr. Wizard, you got some words to start us with?
Yeah. This is from the poet Walt Whitman, written, I reckon, 150 years ago or so. He wrote in Leaves of Grass, titled To Him Who Was Crucified. And it goes like this. My spirit to yours, dear brother. Do not mind because many sounding your name do not understand you. I do not sound your name, but I understand you. I specify you with joy, O my comrade, to salute you and to salute those who are with you before and since and those to come also. That we all labor together, transmitting the same charge and succession. We few, equals, in different of lands, in different of times. We enclosures of all continents, all castes, allowers of all theologies, compassionators, perceivers, rapport of men. We walk silent among the disputes and assertions, but reject not the disputers nor anything that is asserted. We hear the bawling and the din. We are reached at by divisions, jealousies, recriminations on every side. They close peremptorily upon us to surround us, my comrade. Yet we walk unheld, free, the whole earth over, journeying up and down till we make our ineffable mark upon time and the diverse eras, till we saturate time and eras, that the men and women of races, ages to come, may prove brethren and lovers as we are. Walt Whitman.
Yes, Walt Whitman, the true democrat of the spiritual, or the democracy, meaning all human beings have a right to bask in the spirit of the beloved. And in some ways he celebrated that in his writings in a way that that is ecstatic and beautiful in its way. And I guess you decided to read that, Wizard, if I'm not mistaken, because in some ways he's alluding to what we may be alluding to when we retitle our show here, Folk Fellowship.
Yes.
So folk means people, everybody.
Belly button, membership button.
Everybody. Yeah, I guess Adam doesn't have that. Adam didn't have a belly button, you know.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Maybe he got one after Eve got extracted from his side, but that's neither here nor there. So, and then, you know, and I think that's actually a real point. You know, one of the issues in human rights legislation that's evolving more in Europe than in the United States, unfortunately, is that all people have, you know, an innate, inalienable right to, you know, life, liberty, to the education, to housing, to work. They have a right to work, and they have also a right to dignity. They have a right to be protected by laws. They don't have they have a right to not be enslaved or otherwise exploited. In this view of human beings having these innate rights, and this is and people are not abridged from these rights because of your gender. You don't have less rights because you're a woman than if you're a man, and a variety of, or for that matter, even a child. A child also has these rights. Now, of course, when these rights begin or how they begin is has been made into a contentious thing because of the issue of the so-called rights of the unborn and people who find abortion as a form of the indignity of human rights, and it is obviously an issue of contest, but you know, that's it. Everybody has these rights, and this is going to become a norm for world civilization as self-engendered, and it may be that we don't live up to it in any kind of real sense. We have more slavery in the world today than we did at the time of the Civil War when Whitman was alive and thriving. There's more slavery in the world today than there was then, you know. And though slavery is supposedly universally outlawed, it is also in many places, probably too many places on our planet, is condoned.
There's one right that's really inalienable, and that's the pursuit of happiness. And regardless of our circumstance in life, that's a pursuit that's worthy.
Well, Aristotle sort of said that in a way that was what the purpose of life. If you're going to have a purpose to life, it was to find, you know, some contented state, some state of equilibrium in which one's own sense of good was magnified. I would abridge that right to the degree that my pursuit of happiness should not be based on the suffering of others.
That's one's own pursuit of happiness. One can be happy.
You know, but maybe, you know, maybe if my happiness is your misery, then it may be that my happiness needs to be examined. You know? You know, and it may be that you may decide that maybe my happiness isn't such a good thing after all.
Of course, from the spiritual perspective, you can't pursue happiness.
Well, what is the spiritual perspective you're talking about here?
Well, you can only be happiness.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, you said it was a pure spiritual perspective. I asked you, the question was, what is a spiritual perspective? And you say you can only be happiness.
Yes,
so what is so tell me what this be is you're talking about.
The spiritual perspective is that you cannot gain happiness. It's something that is already intrinsically part of who you are, and therefore it's an act of realization.
So if I'm starving, I can still be happy because it's intrinsically who I am, even though I am slowly but surely wasting away because I don't have my basic needs met.
Yes,
this is nice to know that you can be happy starving, people.
Sure.
But I don't think that's you know, I think that there's a you know, in terms of the you know, the basic biological basis of human existence and social basis of human existence, we should have access to, you know, a reasonable amount of food. Not as much as I eat, of course, but a reasonable amount of food and a reasonable amount of, you know, social placement. You should have a sense of belonging, and you should not be coerced or put in pain or ridiculed. I'm sorry, I'm ridiculing you about your ideas of being, but the you know, if that's what you feel. But the you know, I mean, you know, so there are some basic, you know, human needs that I'm not going to claim that spirituality trumps them, at least not the way that you've defined it so far. If you want to define it better, then I'll listen.
Well, if your idea of a life well lived is to have all of your basic needs made over some extended period of time, then what you say is true. But say, for example, some guy has an office job and he feels like he's dead, and he goes out on a vision quest into nature, and he doesn't do a very good job of preparing, and let's say he starves to death over a month, I'd say it's quite possible in the last 3 weeks before he dies, he will experience things and come to places he never would have dreamed of, and who's to say it wasn't worth it?
So, Trip, when are you going on your vision quest?
I've been a few. I brought enough snacks.
You somehow managed to survive by eating them slugs and stuff that you could find under the rocks and whatnot.
So you want me to ask my question here?
No. Let's see what the wizard's got to say here.
What is happiness? What is true happiness?
That sounds like a happy question. Why don't you say what happiness is?
There's an idea that we embrace very powerfully about mortal existence. There is an idea about...
That means we're going to die, folks.
there's an idea that the little narrator I in the head bone is who we are. And that narrator I is married to a body mind.
Mm-hmm.
And
it has to have its needs met and has to fit in society, needs to work and needs to do this.
That body
wants to procreate, et cetera.
Yeah, that body mind has got a biological bent on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going. Its destiny is old age, sickness, suffering, and death.
Yeah, well, that's how we die. Eventually, we're going to all get old, and a couple of us here are representatives of that. As we get old, we're probably going to notice that we can get ill, and we notice that we're going to get ill, we're going to suffer.
Yeah, and times.
And not only that, but when we get ill, people are going to stay away from us because we're not as pleasant as we used to be, or as pretty as we used to be. Or as sexy as we used to be, or exploitable as we used to be.
So
we're going to be abandoned, folks, and then we're going to have the misery of our death, all alone.
Yeah, in this biological paradigm, then where is happiness? It's a tough to find. So there's the...
So is it accepting those conditions and saying, well, that's okay. I had a pretty good run. You know, I had, 60 good years and 10 pretty bad ones, rank things, I kind of wish that I had appreciated my youth when I was a youth more than I did, and et cetera. And I kind of wish I appreciated my health more than I did when I had my health, but, not a bad run. What's old?
The ancients, the wisdom of the ancients.
Oh, he's quoting the ancients. Okay,
the ancients, the wisdom of the ancients, which is the wisdom still the domicile of the wise, have underlined one message throughout our recorded history,
and it ain't to be satisfied with what you get, but.
And that message is, we are not mortal beings.
Oh. So though there is this universal characteristic, the classic one of the grieving widow who went up to the Buddha with her dead child and said, Buddha, make my child, bring my child back to life. And the Buddha said, well, I will do this. If you can find me one house that hasn't experienced death. So she went out and she went into all these places, and everywhere she went, she found everyone had experienced death, and she could find no place that didn't experience death. And she went back to the Buddha and she was distraught, and he said,
so the what dies?
What dies?
And the fear of death is around that little voice in the head, that little narrator I. That's the part that fears death.
But we're talking about something different here. We're talking about a mother who is distraught because of the pain of her child's death, not her own death. That's selfishness. Being concerned with your own death is pure selfishness. But being concerned for some other one's life, that may not be quite as selfish. Of course, it might be from the point of view of the mother. You know, it's an extension of herself. But
when we say self,
okay,
there's in our minds,
and I mean this animal self. You know,
this narrator I, the ego I, the part. The I am is the first thought, then the second thought is I am this body, and then the subsequent thoughts are I am this body in the world, and here are the circumstances.
For some reason, when I think I squeezed out of my mother's womb and came booming into the world, I doubt very much that the first thing that came out of my mouth was, I am. I'm pretty sure it was, yeah!
But the beingness was present.
Uh-huh. But there wasn't any language yet.
There wasn't a language.
I wasn't
yet. Languaging
Mr. I am.
So at 2 or 3 years old, then you one phrase or a few words start to stick.
Yeah.
Stick, and then...
No. And everybody then, has a terrible tooth. You got a grandchild in there.
Then, like, peace is a person who collects string, balls of string.
Right.
Then they take every thought and tie it on to the end of that thought until you get this incredible ball of thoughts, bundle of thoughts called the mind. And...
which are really aping the noises that your parents made to you, and that your siblings made to you, and that your cohorts made to you, that claim that they represent something that's called thought.
Correct.
Yeah.
So we are not our thoughts.
And
we are the witness of our thoughts.
We are the witness of our thoughts.
Yes. And thoughts come and thoughts go. There's nothing permanent about a thought. It's something that's passing through like a cloud in the sky. It leaves the sky unblemished.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we're little kids, you know, some of the things that we are strongly attached to. I mean, they're very hard to be unattached to your mother, your father, your family. And they're really strongly, strongly attached to these things.
That's biology.
Yeah, it's still biology. Well, yeah, but let's not put biology down. Let's just say, you know, let's deal with what those attachments are.
Yeah, not putting biology down. Biology is a natural function.
Right.
And where we lose happiness, inherent happiness, is when we identify with that bundle of thoughts and identify with the mind and the body. That's where the unhappiness comes in.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that the identification or the attachment is actually formed before thinking into this little thing of having a sense of belonging that belongs to mommy and belongs to daddy and belongs to family. And that's where we seek some kind of security. Things change, but we're still looking for the illusion of security, which, if we're good enough parents, we provide it for our kids. We protect them enough so that they have a sense that things are clear enough and safe enough, that the world is stable enough, that they can be okay, that they can survive. And if they survive long enough, then they start thinking. They don't start thinking yet. But when they start thinking, underneath all that thinking is this heavy-duty attachment.
Well, who thinks?
Who thinks? Well, we're saying this person thinks, who has already imported a huge amount of experience, which was, you know, before you become self-reflective in your thinking, you've already are already deeply enmeshed in profound human attachments to other people, to a profound sense of illusion that the world has some kind of permanence and that one can get some kind of happiness out of it, that the world is either fundamentally good or fundamentally not good, and all based on the happenstances of experience, that we've learned a language And in that language has given you the capacity to start understanding that you can think, and that the thinking is not directly the same thing as the language you have. So in other words, so you have a tremendous amount of preconditioning going on there before you get to this meditative thinking state that I think you're alluding to. I'm not saying you can't do this, but I don't think you can do this. Actually, well, that's not true. I think you can do it at starting at a really early age. I think you can start teaching kids how to meditate from an early age.
Let's look at the Dalai Lama and how they picked the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
And they never miss. That's because they can't miss.
Because they educate the guy for 40 years after they pick him.
Because they start from the premise that it's an immortal being. Always. From birth all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And it sticks. It works. If we each treated one another in the same fashion, we'd have
if
a
we're all educated as like the Dalai Lama, we'd all be the Dalai Lama.
We'd be Dalai Lamas, yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it takes 40 plus years to become a Dalai Lama.
And
I mean, most of us at best get 20 years of education, if that much.
Well, there are two kinds of education.
Mm-hmm.
There's what we get from books and alphabets that we put into our minds.
Or get put into our minds for us.
And then there's what Albert Einstein said, the only thing that interferes with my learning is my education.
Okay, what do you think he meant by that?
I think there's I think that the difference between the Dalai Lama and each of us is that from the get-go with the Dalai Lama, there's the collective assumption on the part of everyone around him that then becomes his assumption about himself, that he's divine. Okay.
Yes.
And then with guys like you and me...
Wait a minute. I like to be a little clear about Buddhism. The Dalai Lama is not divine in Buddhism. It's not a correct attribution.
But he's happy.
Okay, well.
Or he's the Dalai Lama, right?
He's happy.
Yeah, or whatever it is. But he's not divine. Divine is another religion.
Well, I use the word divine loosely to mean that there is a permanent, indestructible aspect of ourselves that persists beyond.
And that would actually be that would not be asserted by Buddhists, by
all
the
right.
way. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear right. that they don't believe in they have an anatman, a fundamental belief, which is that there is no permanent indestructible self. And you know, that was fundamental and problematical for Buddhists.
As form, in formless, when one recognizes or recognizes their own being as immortal, transcending the physical body, then those questions don't arise. You're prior to thought, you're prior to form, which is the case already
yep.
with everyone.
Right.
Well, little
and,
children,
and
old grandpas.
Yeah, in some ways, we're going to be exploring these topics ad nauseum in a variety of ways with various guests. But I do agree with you without belaboring it too much that whatever this innate, and we won't necessarily call it permanent or spiritual or anything. I don't want to necessarily give it a name. But whatever it is that human beings have, and maybe just living things have. In other words, I'm not going to make it just exclusively humans. But whatever it is, that people have this innate capacity to realize their own happiness, to realize their own whatever it is they want to realize. And people define it endlessly different ways, some of which are functional, some of which are dysfunctional, probably most of which are dysfunctional, and all to degrees of various mixes. We're going to call this our lives. And I think that's the folk that we're talking about. And then we're talking about folk fellowship. And so the other thing, of course, then is what is the fellowship?
Well, if you let's say you take a wall, big wall, and the wall represents everyone.
Okay.
Then a religion comes along and draws a circle on that wall and says that everyone inside this circle has an inside track to be on the wall.
They know the truth. They've heard the truth.
Then other circles appear on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You've got big circles, little circles, oblong circles. They're all written on the same wall.
And a couple of them overlap. Yeah,
some of them overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a line in between those circles.
Mm-hmm.
That's all part of the fellowship, too.
So it's, in other words, so it's the innate capacity of being alive, of being a human being, of being alive, and or even just being alive and not just being a human being, that one is this folk, and the fellowship is the sort of undrawn. In other words, it's what we share in common before we draw the circles of belonging or identification.
Yes. And if different cultures have different names,
yeah,
in
or different languages, yeah.
Yes. If you go to India, the unorganized fellowship there is Hindu. There's no organization. There's no high priest.
Well, it's Santa Dharma.
There's as many religions as there are people.
Yes.
In Hinduism, so that's a folk fellowship.
Yeah, the Hindus want to call their own religion now Santa Dharma. Santa Dharma, which is kind of easy to remember. Santa, meaning, you know, like Santa Claus. Santa Dharma is what Hindu religion is. They don't like the word Hindu because it was a form of colonial imperialistic view. So to the degree that we can remember that, we can say Santa Dharma is the innate religions of India, of which there are many.
Japan, for instance.
Right.
Japan, you have your formal religion, which is Buddhism.
Number of Buddhisms, yeah.
And then you have a folk fellowship there.
The Shintos?
The Shintos. Shintos, you don't join it. You can't quit it. There's no priesthood.
Well, actually, that's not true. There is a priesthood, and there are sects of Shinto, and some of them are hereditary priesthoods, and some of them are shamanic priesthoods, and some of them are more Buddhistic than others. And so it's a mix like everybody's, but it is based on kami, but kami is strongly based on place. So the kami of this river here is different than that river over there. Yeah, so in other ways, it's kind of drawing the circle.
You go to Jamaica,
right?
Rasta.
Now you see, I can't deal with Jamaica because I haven't been there. So you got the Rastafarians, but you got various forms of Christians there too. Various forms of revivalistic Christianities floating around.
There are plenty of circles on the wall, and there's that that's in between.
But here's the interesting thing. They may be imported into these circles because their family was part of these circles when they were being brought up. In other words, it's part of your heritage that you're part of this circle. I mean, most of us who might be Christian or might be Jewish or whatever, or Islam, we're that because our families were that, and we were brought into it. We were sort of adopted into it. And it was a choice made for us because our parents were in some degree identified with it or not identified with it. It may be that our parents were secular humanists, atheists, and gave us that wonderful value system, wondering what the heck's going on.
So when we define,
yeah,
I can say I am an Advaita Vedantist.
Okay, Advaita Vedantist is...
Then that starts to limit that sense of being. I am a such and such.
Right, any kind of identification or label.
So then, with introspection, if you look at the I am such and such, the such and such falls away, then the I am remains, then the statement of I the statement of I, that I in the middle of that, I, me, my, mine, attention goes on to that, and it will disappear. It will literally and utterly disappear, leaving the residue of who you are as formless, and is perceived directly.
This is sort of the being that's left when you're not trying to do anything.
That's correct.
You know, so when you're through with your doing, you can start being.
Yeah. Exactly.
So in other words, this is one way to get rid of the crap inside yourself. Right?
But I got some tough love though for the.
All right.
Yeah, I got some tough love for the Folk Fellowship.
Okay.
Yeah, because on the one hand, the Folk Fellowship is this loose sort of umbrella of, like, in our local community, we have Wiccans. I made some notes here. We got men's group. I participate in a men's group that's absolutely convinced that they're Palladians circling the earth. They're going to beam up the worthy at the end time, okay? You know, you've got... I've been with a bunch of white guys sitting around a fire doing a corn ceremony for prosperity in the new year, okay? So I could go on and on with about 10 other types of...
So these are ways that you entertain yourself, huh?
Well, so these are all people who are in the Folk Fellowship, and there is a certain amount of spirituality that's being practiced there, and it's all good. But I think it's maybe high time for the Folk Fellowship to raise its game, and I think that there's a requirement there. And I think the requirement is the effort put forth by each individual to see behind the facade of the me, my that you were just talking about, that small I, and to yearn for that direct experience of that residue that's left behind, that's absent the individual that is, you know, gumming up the works. And that is the singular route by which anyone experiences this thing that we label realization. And so...
I'm interested in what you're saying, but I think we need to try to clarify it. I think we're dealing with some serious degrees of unclarity here. So let's try to narrow down what you're really trying to say, Tripp. So there's a great deal of varieties of the way people choose to be religious or spiritual. Some are named, and some have, you know, hoary traditions that go back thousands of years and have many books to justify them. And some of them were made up last week or are going to be made up this afternoon. But the point is that they all think. Now, from my point of view, from the Folk Fellowship, what a person brings to these degrees of spiritual practice or religion is they bring their own authenticity. And that's the funny thing about it, because they are naturally authentic, which is, from my point of view, part of what the Folk Fellowship is. People bring their own natural authenticity, and they make authentic, which is fabricated. You know, it's not because it's not because what they're saying is objectively true. You know, it's not like the Palladians who are going to be beamed up at the end of the time is going to be objectively true, that when people die, they're suddenly going to, you know, get lifted up a beam of light and go back to Sirius or wherever it is they belong. But the person's authenticity that's preordained allows that to be an aspect of the truth. They don't make it true. And in fact, what they've actually done is, in some ways, they've traded their natural gold that they carry within themselves and said it is as worthless as whatever the substitute is. And the substitute might be manure. It might be friendship. It might be sexual enthrallment. It might be wealth. It might be prestige. You know, there's all numbers of things. It doesn't even need to be a religious thing. It could be just the way you occupy your life. What are the things that you are concerned about in your life? those things are naturally authentic because you're paying attention to them. But what you're doing in some ways is you're paying attention with this, you know, pure gold, this pure essence of liberation, and you are paying attention to something that isn't liberated because it isn't aware and it's not conscious. But you're giving it awareness, and it could be a mythology, it could be a religion, or it could be, you know, the sense of stability I have in my family and my that I get from working my job, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on, Mr. Wizard.
I want to get back to the fundamental happiness, the equation for happiness.
Which is, I was calling self, the self-authenticity.
And happiness is not the ego getting what it wants. When the ego,
disappoint me. I mean, I'm disappointed. I've been working on that hypothesis most of my frustrated life. And
when the ego gets what it wants, there's a temporary happiness, and then the dis-ease comes back ever stronger, so it can't be satisfied.
So when I bring my natural self-aware authenticity to something that is ultimately not aware, I'm not going to get any more awareness out of it than what has already been brought to it by me in the first place.
Right. So the I am the body idea is the idea that relinquishes itself.
Through death and other diseases.
Through mortality's undoing.
Yeah.
And it's a natural process. It's a natural, organic, real process.
Or it can be very sudden.
It could be sudden.
But I wanted to add something to what you said, because the happiness quotient in my life increased dramatically about 3 years ago when I was walking through John's bedroom and there was an open book there. It was a picture book of Ramana Maharshi's, and a few words just grabbed me, and I went back and I started reading, and there were only a few words on each page. It was mostly a picture, and after I flipped through about four or five pages, tears just came streaming down my face. I had a total meltdown because I had finally found the truth that had been expressed to me in a way that I could assimilate. For some reason, I don't know why, the way it was expressed there, I could assimilate. But this is the point I want to get to. Those tears had two components to them. There was the joy of realizing the truth, but there was also the certitude that in realizing that truth was going to require a kind of suicide on my part. And I was going to have to let Trip die. And that is a prerequisite to walking around our lives here, our daily lives, and all the frustrations that come up each day, as long as this guy Trip...
In other words, not to die, you have to die.
Well, you can have faith.
Well, actually, that's what Muhammad says. He says, die before
right.
you die.
Just have let go now.
Exactly.
Let go now, and then you won't hit the brick wall.
Exactly. Die in this lifetime and you never hit the brick wall.
So that which is permanent doesn't die, that which is temporary does.
Well, and the knowing the difference is part of what the Folk Fellowship's about.
Yeah,
exactly.
And it's where the sense of being, the local sense of being, is that attached? Has it attached itself to that narrator eye, that conversation that's always going on in the mind as who one is? That's a temporary place. It's a shaky place to hang your identity. And once that is dealt with, looked at, inspected, it will vanish. It'll come back, but it'll vanish. So it's not permanent. What's permanent is the witness of that, and that witness is immortal. And once experienced, you'll understand it. You'll have a subtle intuition that's totally unshakable about that truth. It can't be known with the mind. But the mind can be pacified from that experience.
Well, which means that you can be at peace. In other words, in the sense that the mind has a sense of quietude and is not constantly searching, constantly looking for something new.
Yes. And so what I would like to add is that which binds the folk fellowship, the cement that holds that what you fictitious entity together, is not all of these kind of alternative paths that everybody's taking, whether it be Rasta or Wiccanism or whatever, but it's that death in life, that surrender of the I am ego mind-body identification in some form or other that leads to peace. So you do have to give it up now if you want to live in a state of eternal life.
The thing I disagree with are the conditions you're putting upon it, which are, you have to do this to do that. Actually, you don't have to do anything. The fact of the matter is that the reality of this witness consciousness that it abides forever and at all and is the true immortality, and that and is the basis of our own awareness, that is what we are. And though it seems to require death if we have identified with the impermanent as permanent. Yes. To the degree that we are identified with the impermanent and give it in the impermanent a sense of permanence, then when we go to the true permanence, we seem to have to die. Yes, that's definitely probably true as an experience. But that experience is not universal, because what the folk fellowship is based on is on the pre-reality, the natural reality, that the unborn, undying, natural awareness of each human being is already pristine and doesn't require a path, doesn't require an instruction book. But each person, though, has to basically know it for themselves.
No, all right, no, you're right. But it's like this. You ever see? I've got friends. I know some beautiful women. They're absolutely gorgeous. Okay,
and they. So that's why he's hanging out with the Wiccans. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they can't get it. They can't accept that they are beautiful. Have you not known? This is true of a lot of beautiful women. They can't accept that they're beautiful. Doesn't matter how much you tell them.
Really great, because if they thought they were beautiful, they wouldn't be hanging out with me.
And I would say that this thing that you just mentioned is, it's not, you don't have to do anything, you're correct, but you have to accept something. And so even though all of us are in our ultimate nature, we are all divine. By that I mean that there is something that persists beyond our bodies. 99.999% of humanity, even those that practice religion devoutly, will not accept that. And so I do accept that.
Well, okay.
Okay? I accept that about myself.
Yeah, okay. Well, you see, this is where I also draw the line a little bit, mainly because I really do think that men and women approach their own authenticity, which is what we just defined what authenticity is, which is this pristine, natural witnessing awareness that is already fully ensconced in itself and doesn't need to be realized per se, because it is the real. I think men and women tend to approach those things a little differently, and I think that the way they're approached differently, for one thing, one of the ways that women approach this is that they are much more engaged in the commonality or the mutuality of each other. In other words, women care about each other. They exist in community, whereas men have a tendency to think of ourselves as sort of solitary hunters, you know. I mean, we may band together so-and-so, but we do so in loose confederations that are... whereas women are much more cooperative, and so they see this thing as in a more cooperative approach. So when I think of folk fellowship, I'm really thinking of men and women who and the vast array of the way people are approach, their natural authenticity. And the way that some of them will do it, and they'll never meditate. They'll their entire life, meditation, it will never have an attraction to them. And yet they can be profoundly happy and profoundly realized in this situation because it isn't anything that they have to achieve. It's already there.
Right. Correct. It's an error to consider spirituality is owned by religions.
Yeah, I agree.
That's a tiny slice of the pie of life. It's the truth is expressing itself omnisciently through everything in life.
Yeah, you know, both the stuff that we enjoy and the stuff we begrudge.
Yeah, everything is a play of consciousness when seen from the outlook without the ego eye. It is all perfect. Everything is perfect. Every action is perfect.
So what are the qualities of the ego eye? There are qualities to it.
Me, me, my, mine.
Well, that's one, yeah.
It's a contraction.
That's a good way to put it.
You mean contraction, like I'm about to give birth and I have this little pain?
Yeah.
Make a fist.
Okay.
You just make a fist and hold it.
Holding the fist, this tightness is my ego?
Yeah. That's a contraction, and it almost takes a separate life in your fist.
To
get that to go away, you open your fist and that sensation is gone.
And the inner dialogue that's going on, you see my fist is contracting and opening, you know, so it's blah, 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 blah. My fingers are going blah, 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 blah. And that's the internal dialogue that we hear inside ourselves, me talking to myself saying, well, I exist because I'm important, because I do this, because I'm saying that, and therefore I am. So all of this is this ego consciousness. And if a silent, well, for one thing, we don't allow silence on the radio, folks, because you might, I think we're not broadcasting. But if I'm silent for a moment, not too long ago, but if I'm silent for a moment, my ego might think that it won't exist unless it's expressing itself, which is this contraction you're talking about, right? So that's another aspect of the ego.
The knot in our gut.
So it's definitely...
It's the same as clenching our fist.
Yeah.
It's a self-generated contraction.
And so again, it has an awful lot to do with all of our achievements. Everything that we can achieve and do, right? You know, no matter what it is, a great artwork, you know, to great literature, to... great accomplishments in industry and finance, whatever it is, whatever ledger main you happen to be involved with, all of that is based on a sense of doing that, and the sense of doing is owned by this sense of limited self, me, I.
Yes.
You know, even though I might extend it, you know, that me and mine has, you know, a wife and a few kids and some friends and so forth, in which I, you know, stack up as part of me, as extensions of me, but it's still this based on this sense of doing, right?
Yep.
Which is kind of illusory in a way.
Yeah, it's a horizontal paradigm. It's made of yesterdays and tomorrows that don't exist.
Right, and it's based on a sense of achievement or not achievement.
So it's a hallucination of yesterday and tomorrow and
right.
time.
Right, and let's face it, most of us, and this is what I think Tripp was trying to say when he was talking about that 99%, is that most of us only see the horizontal.
That's correct.
And we're caught in this flow of time, of beginning and end, and of achievement and non-achievement. But there is another dimension. Ta-da!
He's made the vertical.
And okay, so what's the nature of the vertical?
The nature of the vertical is that the now is absolutely still. The now is not moving through time. The now is absolutely still.
So in other words, this now is fully now and doesn't stop being now because I stop talking.
Ever. The now is
a
forever.
Big, expansive now that it takes in all those little infinitesimal nows. It holds them together in a timeless now.
So in this timeless now,
mm-hmm.
there's a light show. And the light show, if you take the equation E equals MC squared and you move to the left and you get into the east side of the equation, mm-hmm. it's all energy. Mm-hmm. There are no nouns.
Mm-hmm.
None whatsoever.
Right.
So if there are no nouns, then what you hold on to is your sense of being. There's nothing left.
Well, you don't even hold on to that because you're just flow.
You're undone.
Just flow.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting things about flow, is when we usually think of flow, we think we're doing something, and we think we have to do something about that doing. And the interesting thing about a flow is we're not doing anything. We're going with it.
That's called synchronicity.
It moves by itself.
Yes.
It moves us, and we are not moved by it. And this is being, but it's not necessarily the static sense of being that most people think of the term when we mention it.
So one of the nice things about getting older is that people tend to get more at peace. And the reason that happens is, I think, because your capacity exactly. As your capacity for doing is diminished, you are forced from this doing paradigm that you've had your entire life as a young man pissing in the wind and running against up the hill. Now you can't do like you could before, so you're naturally gravitating toward simply being. So you're shifting from doing to being. And this little notion of a paradigm shift from doing to being is something that seems to elude the vast majority of people. And it's something that's particularly difficult in the American culture that celebrates doing like you wouldn't believe. And
Well, I mean, American culture is primarily a culture that is sort of wickedly horizontal. And I think the interesting thing about our horizontality is a lot of our so-called spirituality is taking the conditions of the horizontal and insisting that they're also vertical.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And so we're insisting that doing, for instance, is actually being in the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And getting what I that prosperity is being poor in spirit.
like the commercial image is everything. That would be the penultimate expression of basically bullshit is everything.
Well, yes, right. And remember, we're on the radio.
We're on the seven magic words.
Yeah.
I've been pretty good. I waited till 3 minutes. Before.
That's all right. That's all right. We'll let you pay the fine if we get fined. Okay. Okay, Trip. We'll just pass that. We'll just pass that bill on to you. So I hope we didn't scare anybody by our blunt language here, but the. So this is sort of an idea. We're sort of circumambulating this idea of the folk fellowship, and of course, then we have to go on with the other aspects of our new title, which is with the Wizard Baldur, Mr. Wizard. You want to say something about yourself?
Well, I'd like to say something about the folk fellowship.
Oh, okay. We'll let him talk about himself next time, folks.
But the folk fellowship already exists. How folk fellowship is not owned by a religion, by a theology, by a philosophy. It's unowned. No dues required, no diplomas, no schooling required. It already is. It's the obstacles of thinking that we are the thinker that prevent us from recognizing that truth. However, as we meet one another, we recognize a fellowship of sorts. That's love. It's the common oneness.
So in other words, to the degree that we may be aware of our verticality, with as we're sort of clunking along on the road of horizontality, the fellowship we recognize is when we recognize a sense of verticality in others.
Yes,
and that may be a limited sense or a more scopic sense. You know,
a master of happiness, of Ramana Maharshi or Jesus Christ or Mayor Palmer or whatever. A master of happiness only sees happiness. God sees God. ego sees ego. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
When ego sees ego, then that's where we need to work on ourselves to remove, to deal with that, to bring that into the perfection of thy will be done. Because it is all thy will be done. And thy will does not suffer the dilemma of apparent choice. It just is without any obstruction whatsoever.
And on that basis, in our horizontal way, we have run out of that thing called non-existent time. And we're going to wrap up this first edition for the first of the new year of Touchstones Folk Fellowship with the Wizard Baldur and Reverend Paul. I want to thank Mr. Tripp for being here, though I know he didn't have hardly a chance to get a word in edgewise. But that won't always be the case. Well, maybe not always, you know. At least it won't necessarily always be the case. So you're listening to WCOMLP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is your 103.5 on your FM dial. And also remember that you can listen to us on...